is Matt, and welcome to our podcast series, Takeouts, with Ashley Coff RD and Robin O'Brien, discussing better nutrition simplified in the new food economy. Today we have special guest Chef Michelle Nishan on the show. Topics to be discussed are how type 2 diabetes is reversible through food, how can we get better food into schools, why buying local will help America thrive, why kids have to learn to make correct food decisions, how food is the most important factor in your personal health, and how can we spend American taxes better. Right, this promises to be a great one. Hope you enjoy. Over to you, ladies.
Great. Well, we are so excited to be here today. This is such a treat. Not only do I get to do this with Robin, a dear friend of mine, but today I'm bringing on another dear friend of mine, Chef Michelle Nishan, who his bio should literally be 15 pages long and was nice enough to send a short one to us. But we're really excited to bring him to you today. Such a game changer and such somebody has been doing so much of this work for quite a long time, not only as a renowned chef, but also as somebody who's just been a real leader in the sustainable food movement. So, Michelle, just to embarrass you for a moment or to fill all of us with pride, I'm going to tell you read a little bit about some of your accolades. You're two-time award-winning James Beard and also founder, president, and CEO of Wholesome Wave, the co-founder of Chefs Action Network. We're going to get into what all of these pieces are, and also founder and partner with the late actor Paul Newman of the former Dressing Room restaurant. So you've done all pieces and parts, and you have a cookbook, Sustainably Delicious, from Rodale, and I still love to go back to that one, as well as two others, Taste Pure and Simple, and also Homegrown Pure and Simple. So we are so thrilled to have you here today, and I just wanted to dive in with an understanding of what Wholesome Wave is, because I think everybody needs to know what it is and where you guys are today, as well as what Chefs Action Network is. So if you want to share that with us, that'd be great.
Okay, cool. So Wholesome Wave really, to me, was kind of a reaction to the inevitable outcome of my son, Chris, who is now 26, being diagnosed at age 5 with type 1 diabetes. It was about halfway through my career, and I'd already been doing the locavore thing since like 1980. But when Chris was diagnosed, I really understood the impact and the implications of food in our food system on human health. I understood it from an environmental perspective, from a farming cultural perspective, from land conservation and preservation perspective, et cetera. But the human health thing really didn't cross my mind until Chris was diagnosed. And in that journey, when I learned about type 2, that it's actually preventable or reversible through food, depending on what stage you're in, and that the late stage complications, when it's too late, can actually be mitigated through food, I actually got audacious enough to think that we could change the world through food, because it was like, I think at that time, like, you know, 20 million Americans who are suffering from type 2, and now we're up to over 40 and almost an equal amount that are pre-diabetic or undiagnosed. And then I came to the realization that the majority of people who actually suffer from type 2 don't have a personal income that allows them to make the healthy food choices necessary to prevent this horrible disease. So that was kind of the tension point that created the need for me to do something other than a restaurant, because restaurants are not a place where low-income consumers can come as a viable solution to healthier food choice. So I created a nonprofit. So Wholesome Wave is an operating organization. We're now in 40 states with over 100 nonprofit network members working in urban rural communities of poverty, providing affordable food access by doing things like doubling the value of SNAP or food stamp benefits when spent on fruits and vegetables at farmers markets and other direct retail sites, fruit and vegetable prescriptions, partnering with public hospitals and community health centers to help people struggling with obesity, heart disease, hypertension, et cetera, get prescriptions that can be exchanged for fruits and vegetables so they can increase the consumption and improve their health or actually avoid diabetes. And we share the outcomes of our programs with government agencies and lawmakers and work with other stakeholders, creating partnerships within the sector to do things like win the Food Insecurity Nutrition Incentive Program in last year's Farm Bill that provides $100 million in federal money to double SNAP benefits or food stamp benefits when spent on fruits and vegetables. So it's
I want to interrupt on that point for one, because I think it can get lost, like, to hear that something is, first of all, those are amazing numbers in terms of money. Like, sometimes we don't have a sense of how much money is, you know, funded or that piece. But when we hear something is in the Farm Bill, like, sometimes the average person is just says, like, oh, okay, that's a part of the Farm Bill, great, onwards, you know, or we feel really good about it. But, you know, for me, and knowing about the program, but also being in D.C. and believing that, like, first of all, I didn't even think we were going to get a Farm Bill passed. But second of all, the idea that anything could pass, but, you know, at this time, that literally the two sides of Congress could agree on anything. And so one of the things that I just think is exceptional here is you were able to work with and both the Republican and the Democrat side to talk a little bit about that. Like, how did you make – too often we hear that, you know, food or the food issues have become a partisan issue, and that's what prevents, you know, some of the movement forward that we'd like to see. How did you get around that?
Well, you know, first, I think, you know, the approach that we try to take in demonstrating, creating programs that can demonstrate what happens if you spend federal dollars differently, that instead of trying to convince lawmakers that they need to do it simply because it's the right thing to do, or almost have that attitude of, you know, you're David coming to the fight with Goliath with nothing more than a leather strap and a rock, you know, that these are just actually things that make where everybody wins. So, you know, most organizations come up with their vision or the point that they want to prove, and then they laser focus all of their evaluation and all of their message points and all their marketing and all their approaches on that. What we like to do is say, who's there? Who are the decision makers? What's important to them? And how does what we do potentially impact the things that are important to them? So for folks who, you know, are really socially sensitive around food equity issues and things like that, being able to prove that underserved consumers are a powerful buying force, that they actually aren't couch potatoes cramming snack chips and sugary soda, but, you know, single parents working three part-time jobs to equal a full-time job who absolutely want to feed their families well but just can't afford to. And when you actually address the affordability piece, they become a very powerful consumer, but also a concerned parent, somebody who's doing the right thing for their family, that they're a real consumer. Folks on the socially liberal side of the aisle love the notion of how an underserved consumer can potentially be the hero of a changed food system. Mm. On the right side,
yeah, I want to jump in on that, because I think it's a really, really common misperception. And last year, I had the opportunity to work with a few families on food stamps. And, you know, initially the thought was that we could come in and really help teach them and help educate them. And within the first 2 hours of sitting down with them, both of the moms started to cry because they already knew. And they said, you know, we can't afford to do that. And I thought, you know, this is, you know, my life's work is really, how do we refinance the food system? How do we restructure this so that these cleaner, safer options are the more affordable, more viable option for anyone who wants it? You know, and when you look at the fact that Whole Foods as a retailer, as a distributor, only reaches like 3% of all of grocery, you know, that is just such a micro slice of our food system. And yet they've got a huge brand and a huge name and huge awareness, but it's still tiny. And so, you know, you look at companies like Kroger, the way they're moving into this with their private label. You look at companies like Walmart, you know, and it's something I think a lot of people in the movement are struggling with a little bit right now, is, are these big guys really here to play? Are they here just to profit? You know, are they really going to help us restructure? And I think, for me, I came out of a very conservative Texas Republican family, and I look at this as, you know, personal responsibility is a mantra in the Republican Party. And I think for someone to take personal responsibility for their health. They have to know how food is made. They have to know how it's processed. And it has to be available and affordable to all Americans. So, you know, I think the mission that you've stepped into is huge. And it really, you know, is something that is an example of how we need to rethink this, you know, how we need to restructure this.
Yeah, agreed. And what's interesting is, you know, what plays to both sides of the aisle is when you take a look at the underserved consumer who lacks the empowerment, understands because of the easy availability of information through the internet and other channels, they should be feeding their families better, want to feed their families better, can't afford to. That's a 50 million person consumer base that spent $80 billion in SNAP or food stamps last year. And for every food stamp dollar, they spent 91 cents of their own money. So that's a $150 billion consumer marketplace. That's one third of Walmart's global budget, which includes patio furniture and garden supplies and all, and toilet paper and everything else. So the whole notion that what we're talking about here is a very powerful consumer base. Imagine what happens when those consumers learn about the power that they possess in being able to shift their spend. So there's a lot of untapped potential. I mean, we've gotten some progress. When we look at $100 million, it's pencil dust in a $970 billion bill, but it's harder to take something out of a piece of legislation. It's easier to grow it over time than to take it out once it gets in there. So we think the Food Insecurity Nutrition Incentive Program is a big win, but it's one that has to be built on. And, you know, so we were able to speak to folks on the left side of the aisle. We were able to speak to both, helping them understand that this is a real consumer base that we're talking about here. So everybody has a stake in this game. And the interesting thing that we also were able to prove, because we studied the economic impact on small and mid-sized agricultural producers participating in the markets where these incentives were available. And we're now dealing with over 6,000 farmers, but our surveys included 3,200 farmers. Farmers put more land in production. They diversified their crop plantings. They made infrastructural investments in their operations as a result of these exposure to these new markets. The average farmer's market increased their sales by almost 30% by, you know, all through SNAP and incentives. You know, what retail marketplace wouldn't jump at the chance to find an aggregated market available to them that could increase their business by 30%. So when we spoke to folks on the conservative side and talked about those types of economic development impacts, and that's the only thing we talked to them about. You got to know who your audience is. You don't go to someone who's interested in farmers putting more land in production, making infrastructural investments, hiring more people, and talk about how consumers struggling with poverty can be heroes of a changed food system. You know, that's when they put their hands over their ears and say, la, 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 la. But, you know, you talk about jobs, you talk, and you can back it up with numbers. You have people's attention. And when you have conservative governors and commissioners of agriculture in states like Florida, Adam Putnam, who's brilliant, you know, conservative congressman who left the Ag Committee to become commissioner of agriculture in Florida because he thought it was Florida agriculture's best chance for the state of Florida to be its own customer. You know, here's a guy who sees $4.4 billion in food stamps coming into his state and less than 1% of it getting spent on anything grown or processed in the state of Florida, that when you can have something like an incentive program through federal legislation, have people buy produce grown in their own state, if he could get 25% of that money, it would be $1 billion to his ag economy. That's just smart business. So there are lots of ways to speak to people who are decision makers, but it's finding what's important to them and then proving it to be true. And frankly, if you find that it's not true, don't try to spin it. Drop it. Find something else to talk about.
Yeah, it's so true. And, you know, I think one of the really interesting things is that you have this example and through Wholesome Wave. You guys, are you in every state now?
No, we're in 40 of them.
In 40 of them. So pretty much, I mean, when we look at programs across, but, you know, one of the interesting things that we look at is how do we, not every state is going to have the exact same makeup or, you know, the same needs or the same distribution. And so what's been really fascinating to see is how it really needs to become a state management of figuring out what's right, or even from a community standpoint, right, at figuring out how to reach people and what's right. But there are some of these common themes, and I think that's so interesting to be able to see in the different, you know, in the success of the different 40 states that you're in thus far.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think the interesting thing here, and, you know, getting back to Robin's point, you know, it really needs to kind of be community driven, and I think that there's a really huge role for the business sector to play here.
Huge.
You know, and you know, we are, you know, Kroger's involved. We were successful being a subcontractor on a food insecurity nutrition incentive grant in partnership with AARP that includes Kroger's grocers in both Mississippi and Tennessee. And you know, we see, you know, Walmart, you know, having made their pledge that, you know, by the end of 2015, 15% of everything, all fresh food, was going to come from within 150 miles of their regional redistribution warehouses. Well, they surpassed that goal, you know. So, you know, you get big grocers like that who benefit from a significant SNAP spend, food stamp spend. I think Walmart gets about 19% of all food stamp money goes through a Walmart. They're doing those things because it's important to all their customers. You know,
right.
They don't, you know, especially Walmart doesn't niche market. It's low, low prices every day. They don't have a yuppie aisle, but they have the largest organic section of any retail grocer outside of Whole Foods when you look at the amount of retail food space that they have. So these are important players, you know, and I think the role that they can play. And then when you look at, you know, some of these social impact funds like RSF out of San Francisco, TRF, the Reinvestment Fund out of Philadelphia, Imprint Capital, et cetera, Equilibrium Fund, you know, we have to look at the financial instruments that are out there and start asking some harder questions about, are they really appropriate to support the type of infrastructural build-out we need to see to increase the stake that local and regional producers can play in being active parts of the supply chain in getting more whole grains, fruits, vegetables, et cetera. The role that value-added processing can play. These are the same types of supply chain questions and infrastructure questions that could solve problems through value-added processing, like getting more local, regional, healthier foods into grade schools. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for investment in this stuff, I believe, as well.
I totally agree, and I think it's the fastest way through. You know, I mean, when there's obviously, work can get done in D.C., but the fastest way is through the marketplace. And again, you look at what Kroger was able to do back in 2012 when they were considering launching their Simple Truth line, which was, you know, free from a lot of the artificial ingredients and a lot of the additives and junk. And the CEO wasn't entirely sure, but he gave the team enough run room to launch it, and it went from zero to $1 billion in a two-year period, and now that's one of their fastest-growing revenue generators, you know? And so it's like that's going to happen faster than anything that we could do in D.C., and it provides access to families around the country. And then, again, it's do good, feel good, you know, and everybody's winning from this. But I think, you know, you come back to the financial structure, and one of the things that is so deeply concerning to me, and I think it's why we need these big retailers involved, is that, you know, if you look at the growth of, say, like the organic food movement, it's 11 to 14% a year that it's growing, but less than 1% of U.S.
Hi, guys. Sorry, lightning just hit the studio and wiped out everything. We stopped, and Robin is going to pick up where we let off. So if it seems a little bit weird, it's because lightning struck. Anyway, that's El Nino for you. Thank you.
It's a lot of opportunity, I think, right now in the marketplace because, you know, we can sit and we can work and we can wait on D.C., but what we're seeing is that the market is moving a lot faster.
Yeah, I think you're correct. And, you know, examples, to a point, though, and I'll explain that, you know, organic food sales are growing, you know, 17 to 30% a year, you know, based on, you know, based on the year, and, you know, something like over $33 billion a year now of food that's being purchased is organic, and we have to go to China, to New Zealand, to all these other places. But I would say that it's a policy barrier. You're going to have to deal with D.C. because right now when you look at the reason why only large-scale conventional animal production thrives in the United States is policy. Highly processed carbohydrates, transportation subsidies that support these things when fuel gets over, $50 a barrel. It's all policy. And it wasn't by evil intent. I mean, these were policies that were put in place when highly processed carbohydrates meant that food could be shelf-stable for 5 years and, hey, we can feed the world, throw any nitrogen on the ground and corn will grow. Wow, we can feed the world, it wasn't out of bad intent that these things happened in such scale. So we put our policy muscle behind economically supporting and driving that type of production so that we could transition from the less efficient, quote unquote, means of production. It's just our current policy is antithetical to hormone free production, antithetical to organic production at scale. So we have to go to other countries to find that stuff now. So, the interesting thing, and I think this is a conversation that we need to open up in general with the good food movement. When we're talking to folks about this, it's like, wouldn't we rather, and you talk about local and regional, I mean, local to scale would be just buying things from America. If you want to see hormone-free antibiotic beef thrive in America, I'd love to see, all regions of America, all the beef that they're getting is being bought from, Texas, Arizona, California, Florida, places where beef can thrive, on pasture and integrated systems, the right kind of integration between pasture and feed, whatever it might be, more organic, hormone-free, whatever it is, the only way that's going to happen is if we take the Be American, Buy American approach and convince lawmakers that and the American consumer that buying meat from within your own country is the best way to go economically, environmentally, and frankly from a perspective of national pride, which is what some consumers only respond to.
It's interesting you bring that up. Because just this week I had a call with Joel Joseph, who is founder of Made America Foundation, and he is the attorney who authored the Country of Origin Labeling Act, which Congress just said does not apply to meat. And you think about that, and I think about that in terms of food allergies. You think about it in terms of type 1 diabetes with your kids. It's for these parents, they need as much information as humanly possible to protect the health of their children. That nobody signs up for this. Nobody, raises their hand and says, yeah, give me this diagnosis so that I have to know everything I can know about food. But this transparency piece and this food labeling piece and knowing where your food comes from, that is not a fad. It's not a trend. And it's because type 1 diabetes isn't a fad. Food allergies is not a trend. Cancer is not a trend.
And I think we have to be careful in there. And the dietitian in me gets like very, I have a moment of stress and angst that you both have shared, I'm sure, in the parents in that space, and certainly also through your work, which is, I think we've moved to this place of confusing quantity of information with the quality of information. And so I think there's also this place, right, of being able to assure parents, especially in this space when they're trying to deal with something on the health front, not just trying to prevent or have, maintain health, that you have access to the most simple way, the easiest tools. So for me, it's why I love USDA Organic, right? And I understand per this whole conversation that that's not easy or easily accessible for everyone, but at least I can say to someone, hey, that's your best bet at dealing with all of the issues that I'm concerned about. And it's why I'm such a proponent of having a label in our right to know on GMOs. It's that I can't have a hospital said to me, we'd like to be non-GMO, but we don't know that our distribution can handle, we can't know third party that what we're bringing in is non-GMO, so we can't make that promise to our cancer patients, the kids' cancer, hospital. And so I think part of the problem, too, is how do we not fall into this place of quantity of information, but really how do we say we know that parents are able to access the simple information. And I want to use that as a way to sort of angle also over to Michelle to like the other side of your brain, even though both sides demand quite a lot of creativity. But, you know, one of the things I find so fascinating about you is, I mean, you were so far ahead of your time, or maybe you were in the right time and we lost track. But, you know, in this, you're cooking, like the title of your cookbooks, you know, the fact that it's simple and that learning to cook, and I've heard you say to people sometimes, like, doesn't matter what vegetable you use in the recipe, like, here's how, you can use this. So one of the things I want to understand is how can we do a better job of, you know, with the access, helping people feel like they can cook, which to, I think some people feel so off-putting, either from a timing standpoint, or I get a lot of people who now feel like because they watch the TV shows that they can't create the way that the people on the Food Network can, so they just would rather buy it, you know, that kind of a thing. So talk to us from your chef hat for a second about how we can help get people making food for themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in there. So I'm going to give it my best shot, you know, but I think, and it comes from both hats, you know, both sides of my brain. You're assuming that I have a brain. It's all about meaningful consumer engagement. When you're running a restaurant, if you really want to feel full and feel happy, especially if you're not just doing the restaurant because it's a business deal, but it's something that you care about, you believe in, you're exercising creativity, you have values. And when you're in the food business, shame on anybody in the food business that's in it just for the money. If there's a lightning that could strike, it would be the lightning that just pushes those people out of the business. The impact of food as a single subject on human environment, environmental, societal, and economic health is undeniable. So as a chef, the interesting thing is because especially a small business owner chef, you know, you're out in the dining room looking at the faces of people that are consuming your food with a very deep understanding that what they're putting inside them is going to affect them somehow, you know. It really, again, resonated with me when Chris was diagnosed. But the interesting thing is my relationship with my consumers always was, I'd go out in the dining room, they're like, this kind of really weird thing that you're doing, you know, with this particular fish is, you might find it exciting, but it's, you know, or what, you know, you know, you're, you know, you, you've moved in this direction with the menu, but we really like that, you know. None of my restaurants were my vision and me presenting my art on a canvas for people to come in and look at it and take it or leave it. This is what I do. It was never that. Because there were certain values that I had, and I knew that if I wanted to really feel at home and feel solid and proud of my work, because I was relying on taking money out of other people's pockets, giving them food that I was preparing based on my values, for that to actually thrive and survive, I had to have a dialogue with them. And consumer preference taught me that local, organic, sustainable, IPM, gluten-free, whatever it might be, the things that were important, I needed to be able to do things that were important to them. It needed to be nutritious. And even dealing with an elite clientele, still affordability was an issue. There's price comparison competing with other restaurants that were buying out of a conventional system that had a remarkable cost of goods advantage over my business model. So I had to get my customers to come more often, you know, and figure out ways to get them to support me so that I could stay in business at that economic disadvantage. So when we look at consumer education and the way that we present material and bring the consumer along, simplicity is absolutely key, you know, to your point, Ashley. But no one is really bringing the consumer along. There's a lot of marketing manipulation trying to convince the consumer of this wide variety of things that are supposed to be out there. And I think, you know, Michael Pollan kind of distilled it down and said, of, you know, the 10,000 things that all look and feel and are worded differently, they're all based on the same four core ingredients, you know, et cetera. So there's this illusion of choice, and marketing convinces the general public that this is what's out there, and then they're fighting over getting people to choose, you know, their sector of the 10,000 things that are out there, you know. I think the most important thing that the consumer can understand is the true variety of food that's out there. Helping them understand that the easiest choice is actually the choice that the easiest choice to make isn't necessarily the easiest choice to perform. You know, bringing home, you know, whole food or you know, unadulterated food and actually putting it into a meal is the most important time investment that you can make. So these are parents, even in challenged economic conditions, who are spending time to get their kids to an intramural karate class or soccer games or, you know, whatever it is. You know, there are all kinds of things that people spend their time getting their kids to because that's what normal people do in other communities with their kids. To me, it's like, you know, why aren't there, you know, cooking clubs, you know, and cooking teams, and how do you create food as an intramural sport and food gathering as an intramural sport where you get the same type of value of the social activity, the team building, all of those other things, but actually end up where the kid is involved and engaged in cooking their own food, which takes some of the pressure off of the parent, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there are people even in the lower middle class, you know, two parents working two full-time jobs, not at a living wage, but somehow miraculously, you know, the next to latest model of Nintendo shows up under the Christmas tree for Christmas. You know, that's, you know, a couple of $100 that could have been spent on food. You know, so I think helping the consumer base, first of all, very, very clearly understand that the most healthful food actually is the stuff that they buy as close to unadulterated as they can and prepare it themselves. And that the time that they invest in that there is time that they have in their busy schedule that they're doing on other activities that they think aren't important for their kids and might be somewhat important for their kids. But I believe that nothing is more important for their kids than their kids becoming self-reliant on being able to feed themselves good food and how to be able to make those decisions. And that's the type of education that's not happening right now. You know, how do you put a really great meal on the table on a SNAP budget? I don't think anybody's done the full economics of what happens, you know. And again, it gets back to the systemic changes that we're talking about with Robin earlier. When you look at how local and beef production is almost impossible because all of the county meat lockers went the wayside when we could mass produce meat, cut it, put it in cryovac bags and ship it all over the country, and then you just go to a giant grocery store to buy your meat. Well, that doesn't help somebody in the South Bronx get access to protein. But, you know, you look at the whole, you know, meat locker approach where families could go and gather. Imagine five or six families buying, you know, a half a steer and a whole pig. You know, they're going to be paying like $2.99 a pound for all the meat. And if they know what to do with all that meat, and that, you know, meat animal protein only needs to be 4 ounces in any meal that they make, and if they know what to do with rice and beans and other plant-based proteins and stuff like that, very simple productions, and they incorporate the meat into that, you might actually be capable of stretching your SNAP dollar. I still think the SNAP dollars are not enough for a family to put enough good food on the table, but I think it's a combination of enhancing and strengthening that federal program, but also engaging the public in a way that they're getting the right type of education about the economics of food preparation and keeping the food preparation simple and having then the infrastructural system in place so that they can get that food and act like a community. I think one of the greatest community activities when 10 families would get together to buy a half a cow together. I mean, you know, your neighbor meant something other than the person who happens to live in 1B and you live in 1A, you know. This is the person who's like taking the shoulder clot and you're taking the hindquarter, you know.
No, I think you bring
and sharing recipes.
You bring up some really important points, and again, unfortunately, it comes back to funding because, as we know, you know, the education system, I mean, there's a lot that needs to be restructured there. You look at the school lunch program, the funding there is so abysmal that they can't afford, you know, to create the kind of healthy food that a lot of the people I know inside of those corporations would love to be able to create. I've had dads cry because they know that they don't have the budget to put healthy food on the table in the schools. And so, you know, again, it's an opportunity, like we talked about at the beginning, for, you know, a foundation to come in or for some other investment vehicle to come in and help to create a food economic program. And we're starting to see it where you see these gardens that are being installed in schools around the country and the access that the kids are having, the ability to learn. I love the idea of teaching families to cook, and I say that from a very personal place where I had zero confidence in my ability to do it with four small children. And I didn't want to screw up. I didn't want to waste food. I didn't want to burn things. I didn't know how to start. And to give myself permission to start really simply, to do one thing, to let it be messy, to let it be fun. And one of the goals I had was I never wanted my kids to feel as stupid as I felt in the kitchen. And so I had them right in there beside me. And, you know, thankfully today they all know how to cook. But I think, again, it's an infrastructure issue. And there are these huge opportunities. We've just seen somebody here in Boulder, Colorado come in, and she's just opened a food lab. And, of course, you know, she's a mom. She has kids, but she's teaching people how to cook. And I think that opportunity, the way we have food trucks now that move from a farmer's market up to the high school, if you could have, like, a roving food lab, you know, where she can take that into schools and start to implement these programs, again, speaks to just the enormous opportunities there are to create these changes in the system.
Yeah, amen. I'll tell you, you know, that's heartfelt. And, you know, but again, I think, you know, even when you look at the education system, because some of it's funding or it's how do we prioritize, you know, it's like, you know, national tests, you know, test score standards.
So you don't test well on your score. Like, that's the whole part to me. It's like,
you
know,
I talked
to,
well,
like,
your test if you don't have a
like,
belly.
Yes. I was lucky enough to give a talk to a police department, and I love that the police department was basically saying, like, we get that, like, we have to, you know, our health is important for us from a mental and a physical standpoint. And it's like, to me, that's that part that, you know, how can we not, I mean, it's not obviously just that I work in it. It's like, how do we make sure that people know that you're not going to do well on those other things. So it's a limitation on those other investments if we're not taking care of our health, right?
Yeah, no question. So to me, it's like, you know, how do you take a look? You could almost take every subject matter that's weighted and standardized scoring and all that jazz and actually say, okay, does every single student in America have to score X on math, science, this, that, the other thing? You know, there are going to be some parents, and maybe Robin, you'll get mad at me for saying this, but there's like a certain portion of stuff that I learned in grade school, middle school, and high school that I've actually been able to apply to my life, and I would have to say that it's probably less than 25% of everything I was taught. Because there are only certain things that I was interested in. So you look at kind of the magnet school approach, it's like, who are the kids who really gravitate towards science? Who are the kids that really gravitate towards tech, towards math, towards whatever it might be? And it's like, you look in an environment where you know, the kind of unique intellectual DNA of each child is being honored by that type of a focus. And then it frees up time because now you're not teaching them geography and history and, you know, or, other than, you know, requisite amounts so people know what country they came from and where their state is, you know, that type of a thing, you know, or the important parts of social science being genuine human interaction where the successes and failures of that over time. You don't have to go into, you know, the entire history of the Byzantine Empire to learn what worked and what didn't relative to how we're dealing with society today.
Yeah.
But it's like, how do you take those specialties and free up time so that the one thing that all students learn, because all students' very lives and health depend on it, is understand food. You know, if there's one subject that every American student should be highly proficient at, it should be food and food's relationship to their personal health and to the place that they call home. You know, so the mathematicians get to do their math thing, the tech geeks get to do their tech stuff, you know, the biology people get to do the biology stuff. Everybody does food, you know. So it's how do we prioritize, use the same amount of money, but just spend it smarter instead of trying to spread it all so thinly. So there are a variety of different ways to look at it. And we try, even in the stuff that we do with affordable access, we try to look at that. Let's not ask the American taxpayer for more money. Let's take a look at the money that's in the system and demonstrate what happens if you spend it better.
Right. You just need to refinance. That's what, again, getting back to the beginning.
Yeah,
it's like
exactly.
Refinance and restructure it. You know, it's the allocation that we really need to address. It's, yeah, absolutely, 100%. I love listening to you.
I know, like, I'm like, okay, and 24 more podcasts will be dedicated. No, I'm just kidding. But, yes, but we still have one more thing. Go ahead, Robin. Yeah.
So we love to wrap up with a series of questions that we've asked everybody that we've interviewed, and we just want you to answer with the first thing that comes to mind. So the first question is, what's
the
greatest...
Careful what you ask for.
I know.
We're serious, yeah.
What's the greatest obstacle you've overcome?
Myself.
Aww.
You know, yeah, no, seriously. You know, I had, there was a period of time when I was a young culinarian, you know, I came out of it, my family struggled with poverty, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, but I had this unique thing because I grew up on my grandparents' farm, you know, helping my grandfather because he couldn't afford farm workers anymore. So me and all my cousins of his 13 children ended up in Morley, Missouri every summer helping them work the farm. It's where I learned how to cook. I could cook blindfolded by like age 14, you know, smother pork chops, fried chicken, braise things, kill and butcher animals, cure, pickle can, all that stuff. So when my parents fell on hard time and I got a job in a restaurant so at least I could eat, I kicked everybody's ass, and I got a really big ego from that, you know. I was, like, back in the late 70s, early 80s, I was one of the only young Americans in the Midwest, and all the chefs were from Europe because no Americans really knew how to cook because we had become the convenience age country. Yeah, chefs loved me, so I got promoted quickly. My ego grew, and I, you know, I really was kind of like a jerk, and, you know, I needed that wake-up moment. And it came to me, thankfully, I think I was like 20 years old or 19. You know, I was being, you know, a bit of a tyrant and one of the older managers, one of the few people that I actually really did respect, you know, pulled me aside one day and said, you know, dude, as good as you are, you know, I could tell you that we're getting ready to fire you because you're so disruptive and stuff like that. But I think there's a grain enough of goodness in you to where you need to understand that nobody here likes you. You know, you don't give anybody a chance, you know, to have their voice. You talk over people, you know, you're dismissive, and you're just not, you don't have the age, the years in the business and the chops to treat people the way that you're treating them. And the interesting thing is I went home, I was devastated. You know, I cried myself to sleep. I woke up and called it sick the next morning. You know, I'm like, holy shit. You know, so I took a look in the mirror. And, you know, it was a journey. It didn't happen overnight. But what I learned is, especially when I got there and I could outcook everybody, you know, the first reason why I wanted to buy from local farmers was because I saw the food coming in the back door was so crappy that I'd just buy from farmers and then I would crush my competition, because all my ingredients would be better. And then I went out into the countryside to find farmers because I was so naive as to not notice what was really going on with my grandfather's farm, that it was becoming extinct because of the current system. I couldn't find any farmers. And then I realized the only way back to having those great ingredients was that I was not going to be the person who could change that. That if other chefs and other restaurants and we didn't create a community of practice around this type of approach, that it wasn't going to happen. So it took time for me to understand how to let go of I and make we the most valuable word in my vocabulary. You know, so I think I was my greatest obstacle that I overcame. And I'm just so thrilled that guy had the courage to put me up against the cooler wall one day and let me know how everybody felt about me. Because I'm not sure... I think it would have taken me years to find that out on my own if somebody didn't have to have the stones to, and I was bigger than this guy too. So,
wow, that is such a humbling and such an inspiring answer.
Yeah.
Well, so then the next question is, who inspires you and why? And I think that kind of honesty is, what an incredible lesson.
Yeah. I think who inspires me now, it's kind of a general statement, but I think the people who have the least are the people who inspire me the most. You know, generally, you know, as a chef, and I go there like immediately, Jacques Pepin, you know, is a long time hero of mine, guys like, you know, Jose Andres, Tom Colicchio, Marcus Samuelson, Peter Hoffman, Rick Bayless, you know, Nora Puyan, Alice, all those folks, right? But you know, those are folks who have had access to great educations, they've had access to money, et cetera. You know, when I look at some of the folks that we encounter that are struggling with poverty in urban and rural communities all over the country and what they're able to do for their families rubbing two pennies together, it freaking blows me away. It's one of the reasons why I think, you know, what Tom's doing with Food Policy Action, if they can actually start connecting the congressional scorecard that scores all congresspeople on how they vote on food issues and get that information into the hand of underserved consumers and convince them that it's worth showing up at the polls to vote on people, to vote for people based on how those representatives vote on food, that can be the next landslide. You know, so I underserved consumers inspire me the most. It's amazing what they're able to do for their families with the incredibly limited resources that they have.
That's great. So this next one is one of my favorites. What one message would you send to Congress?
Get off your ass and think about the entire American public instead of yourselves. They need the cooler conversation that was had with me when I was a 19-year-old.
Oh, I love that. I literally just got chills. Thank you. That was amazing.
You're welcome.
Yes.
It has to happen.
Yes.
Someone's got to wake these guys up because
They
ain't waking up on their own. They don't even have a fucking alarm clock, pardon my language.
Yeah.
You know? No, I know. I mean, you know, I look at systems and restructurings, and I think term limits would be a great thing.
Yes.
Oh, amen. Oh, and campaign finance.
Yeah, we'll have to do a whole another podcast on that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley, you want to take over from here?
No, you keep going. You're doing great. Yeah.
So this one is way lighter. If you were a food, what would you be?
Rutabaga. Yeah,
pray tell.
Pray tell. I think it's like the most remarkable thing in the world. You know, it enjoys very limited love from the general public, but to me, simply roasting it with almost nothing, it has more flavor. I mean, it's like you roast a rutabaga long enough and slow enough, it tastes like nutmeg, allspice, plums, you know, apples, you know, meat, depending on the soil that it was grown in. You juice it and you reduce it like to a syrup. You can mount it with olive oil. You can mount it with, but whatever, you know, you can make this incredibly healthy sauce. It has its own, you know, vegetable sucrose. It's got pectins in it and stuff. It's an amazing vegetable, and it's so freaking good for you, you know, anthocyanins, all kinds of really great phytonutrients and chemicals in there, incredible source of fiber, et cetera, and just super flavorful. It's like the one vegetable that I love to pair with wine. You know, it's amazing with Alsatian wines, with white wine, with red wine, Pinot Noirs. It's the ultimate vegetable for wine.
Wow, I love that.
That's kind of amazing.
Rutabaga rocks.
All right, you got it. It makes me want to
go make
rutabaga.
Okay, so here's our last one, and I hold an image in my head on this, and I'm wondering what yours is. So it's the year 2050. How does this story play out?
I'm basically, you know, out of work. Because affordable access has happened for everybody. And so many people have become such exceptional chefs at home that there are a lot less restaurants than there are now because everybody loves food so much that they can't imagine themselves not cooking it at home. That wages and the workplace is such a place that allows our society to value food that way. And it's okay that I'm unemployed because I'll have affordable access to food.
I love
That's it. What 2050 looks like for me.
That's right.
That sounds pretty great.
I'm there with you. We're on a boat or an island, and we all get to just relax a little bit because the work has been done. So it'll be great. I love it. Absolutely.
Yeah. We don't care at Wholesome. We really don't care at Wholesome Way that we're the nonprofit that goes away. If we're so effective at getting something done to help solve the problems and change the things that we're working on, mm-hmm. that's as it should be. You know, if we can't adapt, I'm confident and we're confident as an organization that everybody that works here is so freaking talented. If we made our work irrelevant, someone's going to hire us.
No, absolutely.
You need, I mean, it's systems thinking, and you know, right now we're tackling the food system, and
yeah,
there are plenty of others that are struggling too, but I am so glad that you have devoted your life to what you're doing. I'm so glad you took the time to speak with us today. Your insight, the numbers you threw out are extraordinary. And we're just thrilled to be able to share this.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Keep doing what you're doing, and thank you so much. And just the honesty, it was really, I loved it, of course. We are so grateful for you, so thank you. And I have a good feeling we'll be hearing from you again.
What a great show. Thanks for that, ladies, and to Chef Michelle Nichon. Change is in the air. I can sense it. Right. On to next week. Next up, Matthew Dillon. Matthew is Director of Agricultural Policy and Programs at Clif Bar & Company, a leading maker of nutritious and organic foods and drinks for people on the go. Looking forward to it. Right. Until then, see you next time.